Rishus Avimori. It's always a special privilege to be able to join forces, to collaborate with my father, Lita, and particularly in a topic like this, where my father, to me at least, represents, I guess, three different factors. Number one, as a father, whose home I grew up in, Shinantan Levanecha, and from whom obviously my interest in learning and Rabbanus or extended Rabbanus really comes in so many ways. We'll elaborate right now, but obviously that's a crucial aspect. In addition to that, the role that my father played all the years in the Rabbanus, beyond his community, and the impact that he had on the national scene and interacting with other rabbis through Critical Council of America and other such organizations, in dealing with really many of these kind of sensitivity issues that we'll be talking about. And third, not necessarily even less important than the other two, is that for many years I've been a congregant, in the shul. Still live in Kew Gardens, and some of the things that I was able to see in terms of how my father handled certain things and conducted himself with respect to some of these issues, and of course many other issues, also have had a great deal of impact, in my own, in the shaping of my own views and perspectives. So, as I say, it's really a special schus to be able to do this. We've done this a couple of times already, I think it's the third, and each time it's a special opportunity. The topic that we're discussing today, so what we're going to do is, I think what we've done in the past is, I'm just going to introduce the topic and to relate to some of the categories and raise some of the questions and provide a little bit of an overview first. Then we're going to turn to the more practical side, the voice of experience, and not just experience, but perspective on certain issues. And then, whatever time is left, I'm going to go into some of the details a little bit more of some of the topics as we'll discuss. So the topic is the role of the non-observant Jew in the synagogue according to the halacha. Good. And obviously this is a very complex topic, a very wide-ranging topic, a topic that can't be exhausted, can't be properly handled in a single session, even one that runs more than an hour. So the best that we can do is, you have some material in front of you, which is a starting off point in terms of going more deeply into the topic. And the best that we can do, I think, is to provide, as I say, an outline and certain perspectives that hopefully will be helpful. The topic itself is one which, on one level, is indigenous to halachic life generally. There's never been a Jewish community in which there were not avaryanim, for better or for worse. The Gemara says that, the Gemara in Croesus, other places, speaks about that as being, I wouldn't say beneficial, but of being an important factor. Every community has avaryanim. And how a religious community, a community that is committed to Torah and to halacha, relates to those who deviate from that conduct and that behavior is obviously something that's going to come up in any community, in any era, in any geographic location. There, as long as there are going to be avaryanim, there's going to be the question how to engage them or relate to them, etc. The Gemara in the beginning of Chulin, many of you are all Smicha students, so assume you all learned or are learning Chulin. So the Gemara in Masechet Chulin, in the beginning, and Av Gimel, through Davav, discusses the status of Mumrim, Avaryanim, Shumadim, all sorts of different levels of Avaryanim when it comes to the question of Shechita. The Gemara in Masechet Gittin, the Mem Heyud Beis, discusses the status of Avaryanim when it comes to the question of Stam, Sefer Torah, Tefillin, and Mezuzah. Can they produce such things? The Gemara talks about the status of avaryanim of different types with respect to pidyon shvuyim. Also, Gemara in Gittin, a couple of dapim after that, mem zayin amud beis. The Gemara in Horios and the Gemara in Avodah Zarah speaks about the status of avaryanim in terms of the rule of moridin velo malin or malin velo moridin. Right, if you either encounter somebody who is not bikoris, etc., are you supposed to help him if his situation is a dire one? Are you supposed to even initiate putting him in such a situation, moridin? The Gemara discusses that in Chulin and Horios. The Gemara discusses the problem of the karbonos of avaryanim, which of course is particularly avaryanim, generally the people who bring karbonos. We're talking about tachatos and asham. Certainly, even Ola, right, has an aspect connected to Avera, so the idea of karbonos for avaryanim is, I say, structured in. But if somebody is a mumar, if he's too far gone, can he bring a karbon, especially a more voluntary kind of karbon? Ola, things of that sort. So that's a discussion the Gemara has in Avodah Zarah, Horios, Chulin, Avodah Zarah Chavav Medeis, Horios Yod Aleph, etc. So this question of how to deal with people whose behavior deviates from the ideal, even from the norm, is a typical concern of any community, of any rav, any bal halach. However, the events of recent times, modern Jewish history, one might say, certainly make the situation a little different and more acute. As far as we are concerned, the phenomenon of widespread non-observance, even in terms of some basic categories like Chilul Shabbos, never mind in terms of belief, Chilul Shabbos Befarhasya, Kofrim, and yet people who at the same time enter and participate in synagogue life, that's something that is, relatively, given the long history of the Jewish people, that's something that is a more recent phenomenon. The fact that the majority of Klal Yisrael belong to these categories, Ladavonenu, is important too. It also may affect the way that we relate to such unacceptable behavior. Everybody knows the famous comment of the Chazon Ish, about Mumrim or Kofrim, Bizman Hazeh being in the category, of Tinok Shenishba, and therefore the principle of Moridim Velomalin, not applying. There's a less well-known comment in the name of Reb Chaim. He also felt that way, but for a very different reason, not because of the category of Tinok Shenishba, just that he felt that the reality that a majority of Klal Yisrael come under this rubric, that willy-nilly just changes the reality of how you deal with the whole situation. That's a more, again, each one is ambitious in its own way. Each one is a mechudash in its own way. I think there's also a certain maybe pattern in each approach, which is interesting, but not for now. But I'm just trying to highlight the idea that when you encounter a phenomenon, which is, normally in halacha, so whatever the situation is, it doesn't really matter whether it's, it's ner li'echad, ner le'me'ah, or in this case, the opposite. But sometimes the sheer numbers, the reality that a total community has a certain status doesn't mean you sweep it under the rug. It doesn't mean that it doesn't continue to be an issue, but maybe the tactics or the perspective might at least change a little bit. And again, that's something that we confront in this question. Not only has recent Jewish history brought us into contact with a much greater incidence of Avera and Avaryanim, but at the same time, this is what makes this a complex topic. It has an inverse effect as well. The fact that Rove of Klal Yisrael are not Shomrei Torah Mitzvos ends up meaning that the tenuous link that they have with institutions of Jewish life, like the Beis HaKnesses, are actually even more important. So even as there's a bigger problem, right, there's also greater urgency to find, the right solution to this problem. For many Jews, The only connection, the only identification they have with Jewish life is their identification and connection with the rabbi or with the shul that they attend or that they occasionally attend. You know, the idea of a yahrzeit, or people who are saying Kaddish in the context of Avelos, and then, of course, the yahrzeit, or saying Yizkar, I think we all know, has assumed proportions of significance, you know, far, far beyond their actual objective, you know, halachic significance. I mean, these are all nice and important things. You know, they, you know, pale into insignificance. If you're talking about Chilul Shabbos or basic Averos, you know, so, you know, somebody who, you know, is makbid never to miss the yahrzeit or never to miss a yizkar, but, you know, he'll travel, you know, in a way that's Mechal Shabbos or Mechal Yontif or Mechal Yom Kippur to get there. As people who are Shomrei Torah mitzvahs, we understand that that's, you know, absurd, but it's a reality, and it highlights the emotional aspect of those vestiges that people hold on to and how important they are in terms of establishing or preserving that connection and a foundation perhaps for people's return. So the idea that, you know, when there is a yahrzeit or when there is a yizkar or when somebody is saying a Kaddish for a whole year and his kibud av v'eim, you know, we're thankful of it. I say it's a strange, peculiar kind of a thing. People can be strange and peculiar, but we're happy at least for that, not for the Chilul Shabbos that it might inspire, but for at least that level of commitment. The point is we want to encourage that as much as possible, and at the same time we have to contend with the fact that people are strangers to a synagogue and their behavior generally is inconsistent with the kind of standards that we normally require. And the question is how to navigate that dialectic, and that's really part of the topic. Family simchas, sometimes, you know, somebody will not step into a synagogue, but, you know, he's very close to his family, and there's somebody there who's Orthodox or who's a shul goer. When that person comes in, you know, during a simcha, you give him an aliyah, you don't give him an aliyah, he can at least open the aron. What can he do, what can he not do? These are important issues. Yom Noraim, I mentioned Yizkor before, Yom Noraim, again, it's a bit of a dying art. You know, my father will confirm this. You know, when we were growing up, so even the people who, you know, who never frequented the shul during the year and who had very, again, tenuous connection to Torah and to Halacha, but at least to the Yom Naraim, they were there. They were always, you know, a full shul and extra overflow minyanim, you know, in shuls across the land and the Yom Naraim, because that was something. You know, Sandy Koufax understood it, and, you know, others like him understood it as well. You can't not go to shul on Yom Kippur. And the question is, you know, especially at a time, just to highlight it, like the Yom Naraim, where standards should be higher, so what do you do when Avaryanim walk into the shul, and they're in the shul? And, you know, the Rav used to describe, you know, davening in the minyan in Maimonides, and his son, Dr. Soloveitchik, spoken about this as well. You know, and hearing the you know, the clutter of coins, you know, in people's pockets. There were a lot of people there who, you know, either didn't realize or didn't care about that aspect of it, but they were there on the Yom Naraim, and they wouldn't miss. It would be obscene, you know, from their point of view, not to come to shul on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Question is, how do you deal with that problem? On the one hand, we say, you know, when it comes to the Yom Naraim, one should adopt more strict and more stringent standards, you know, Pasakum and Tuma, Chachmi Ashkenaz in particular. You should look for a Shliach Tzibur who is married and Merutza Lakohol. You know, the Hasidic Ashkenaz were strong about this issue generally, but the Halacha people are particularly makbid when it comes to the Yom Naraim, and you want to give Aliyos and Kibudim at this time to people who are deserving and who are role models, etc. And at the same time, here you have an opportunity to encourage and draw in those who only frequent the shul and these particular times. Kol Nidre, you know, when they say b'yeshiva shel mala, b'yeshiva shel mata, you know, anu matirim li'ispalel, you know, ima avaryanim, right, they know whereof they speak. And it's very lemaisa for them. And the question is, how do you navigate that? I like to quote the tshuva, which we have here in our packet. I'll try not to quote too much because it takes too much time, although it's much more effective when you see that things are really there. But on page 21, the Igros Moshe and Chelek Gimel Simin Yud Beis, I just think it's a good snapshot, discusses this problem of giving an aliyah to Avaryanim on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. It says, "Bidvar ha'aliyos l'Torah l'mishen shomer Shabbos." General, we'll talk about that later. Shebiarti shom she birchas hakofer min habracha klal. His view. Then in the middle, towards this is on page 21. So it's towards the middle of the tshuva. Ubiyomim naroim yesh tam lekan ulekan. The rov bnei adam shebaim liyispalel hariyesh lem amuna b'Hashem yizbarach shu kosev v'kosim dina shel adam l'tova chas v'shalom shelo l'tova. V'gam yesh laharbe mehem mimela hirhur tshuva. Siyosi yesh lekarim b'torim b'shar yimos hashana. Right, we're talking about avaryanim, meaning on the one hand, what brings people to the shul is precisely, you know, whatever is left of their sense of commitment. You know, they won't miss a Yom Kippur. And again, unfortunately, it's not true so much anymore. But But the point is that that's good, and maybe Yom Kippur is a day where their, you know, sincerity and their belief is at heightened pitch. On the other hand, the standards of Yom Kippur should be higher. And he quotes Pasakum, things that I mentioned before. But Yoser, his conclusion, Yoser notes urak bedvarim shein nogel acherim, meaning the chumras have to do with each individual and his introspection and his enhanced status during these days. Aval dvarim shechumrahu, right, kula lezalzel bekvod acherim. Again, Moshe is very balanced as always and very consistent. If complex, he's a complex posek. But basically, his view is that one should try to bend over backwards to accommodate. Number one, people are more sincere, and therefore there are less of problems. At the same time, it's a tremendous opportunity, right, to transform people, right, completely, or at least, you know, to maintain their identification and kind of build for the future. And, you know, as long as it doesn't cross that red line, what he calls kofrim, which we'll discuss soon, he takes this position. But he highlights, again, the problem and the issue. The Beis HaKnesses is a mikdash ma'at, and as such, again, that implies very high standards. The Beis HaMikdash is characterized, you know, by the opportunities that are provided for people who, you know, who pay the price in terms of rigorous standards. Right? There are places where you can go, where you can't go. There are places, there are things that only a Kohen can do and not a Zar. There are different machanos. If you're Tamei, you know, you can't be Nichnas as sincere as you might be. The Beis HaKnesses has that aspect of Mikdash Ma'at as well. At the same time, you know, the Mikdash is a place which provides for the potential kapara for Avaryanim when it's done properly. And it's certainly a place, you know, Kibesi Beis Tefila Yikarei L'chalo Amim, a place for Tefila and a place to identify with Klal Yisrael. And there's no question that in our era, you know, the Beis HaKnesses is the single most important, most visible, most effective institution and vehicle for people's identification. And again, that's another aspect, you know, of this dialectic. We have here in the packet some tshuvas discussing the problem when you have to make a difficult choice. Is it better to daven in a shul where you can be mashpia, a shul which caters, you know, to a mixed clientele? In other words, people whose standards might be lower than your own, but by supporting that shul, and also perhaps by, you know, being in contact with such people, right, you know, potentially elevate them and you facilitate, you know, their continued identification and maybe more, at the expense of your own personal standards. So again, Rav Herzog has a very fascinating tshuva, which I hope to get back to later on, where he, you know, tries to bend over backwards to allow for the presence even of almost literal Michalei Shabbos, Lahachis. He tries to find a Pesach for such people, if not to make of the majority of the minyan, but to be mitzdaref as the minority to a minyan, and certainly to be involved in a tefillah, as much as he is also, very aware of and very unhappy about the implications of that. And in a very different walk of life, a different kind of rabbanus, Rav Sternbach, who's associated with the Eidah Charedis and the rabbi in Johannesburg for many years, because he was the rabbi in Johannesburg, so he has this sensitivity as well. Also has very fascinating tshuvas about what to do. Can you daven in a shul where the shliach tzibur, the only shliach tzibur is Michal Shabbos? And a heart-rending tshuva where you have to choose between the shul or in the shul, between the Michal Shabbos, being the shliach tzibur, or the person who is living with a non-Jew. And again, both make the point that the tzad lahakel is not chas v'shalom that these are acceptable things, but that the reality is that you have to have viable batei knesios that are available and that cater, that exist in chutz laretz, where sometimes it's hard to put together a perfect minyan of high standards. Again, things have changed somewhat, and we'll be hearing about that too. But not only that, but because of the role that the shul plays for such Jews, facilitating the viability of the shul becomes a factor in its own right. Again, that's not an excuse or rationalization for everything, but it's a factor to weigh in the bigger picture. So, obviously, part of our topic, and this is the part that's more flexible because every community is different, we'll be hearing about this too, is to try to figure out what the stakes are, what is the potential upside or benefits, what is the constructive aspect of loosening standards where it's possible. Again, things that are, in every halachic issue, there are always things that are just beyond the pale, and there are red lines that you can't cross for anything. But where there's flexibility, even though it's a kind of a b'dieved, what are the benefits, and what are the benefits and what are the dangers? The stirring words of the Rambam, I also like to quote in the Geras Teiman, regarding this question of flexibility, are well worth repeating. Let me just see if I can find it. The Rambam in the Geras Teiman discusses the issue. Discusses the issue, which is very much a factor today. V'chein ein roi laharchik mechal leShabbos v'limos osam el lekarvam lezarzam la'asiyas hamitzvos. V'kvar pirshu Rabbeinu shaposheya impasha b'ritzono k'sheyavu lebeis haKnesses liyispalel mekablenoso. V'ein noagin bo minag bizayon. V'samcha al zeh midivrei Shlomo sh'amar lo yavuzu leganav ki yiganev lemalei nafsho, etc. So basically, the Rambam, calls for at least trying to find a place in the Beis HaKnesses, even for serious and significant avaryanim. And again, this is part of this same dialectic. Tefillah, on the one hand, represents amida lifnei Hashem, with everything that implies. It's important always to emphasize that. If the Hasidim HaRishonim, would arrive an hour early to prepare, so, it's more than just a Davar Shebekedusha. Obviously, it's a perspective on Avoda. It's Avoda Shebelev, Zuhi Tfila. And at the same time, as I said, the idea that, that Tfila would not be accessible, to people who maybe need it even more than the Hasidim HaRishonim do, is the second side of the coin that needs to be factored in. So on the one hand, there's the question of standards. There's also a question on the other side of Chilul Hashem. You want to make sure that the message that you convey, if you are mekel in certain things, to others, is not a message that you're soft on, the standards of Beis HaKnesses, the importance of tefillah, or that you're soft on the unacceptability of certain kind of conduct. It has to be clear if you are Mekel that you're doing so, you know, l'shem shemayim, and to better serve the internal factors, you know, that themselves, you know, make up this dialectic. Moreover, you have to always be concerned about the other aspect of Chilul Hashem, that people will simply misunderstand what you're doing. Rav Moshe Feinstein in his tshuvas is very focused on the problem of chanifa in particular, the idea that, you know, somehow giving a kibudim to avaryanim, you know, isn't that a tacit, I wouldn't say endorsement, but at least, you know, not so terrible. You know, he's a fellow Jew, we can be mechabed him. What does that say about his aveira? He ends up with a very fascinating perspective on chanifa. He thinks that chanifa never applies in a situation where there's no mistaken impression about the acceptability of the practice. In other words, being mechabed, a gavra, you know, who's an avar, who's doing an avera, is not a chanifa problem. You know, as long as it doesn't imply a softer attitude towards the avera itself. But he talks about chanifa and ziyuf haTorah, and you know, we also have to consider, you know, what impact being more flexible has on the parishioners, you know, who are committed or are becoming more committed, and who are inspired by higher standards. That too is surely a very important factor. In other words, some of the general issues that govern kiruv is, you know, kiruv questions, namely how far do you go, you know, who is your target audience, you know, the potential bal tshuva in front of you, but what about, you know, what about the frum people, you know, who are also seeing what's going on, or the people who are, as I say, you know, intensifying their level of commitment and so on. These are issues that come up and that are part of the factors of our Yonim and the Beis HaKnesses as well. Questions of Machlokes and Kovod HaBrios, all of these are things that register in the poskim. What makes this a difficult topic is also the fact that there are different issues and different types of aryanim. So I'm just going to speak about that for 5 minutes, then we'll turn over to some of the practical parts, and then whatever time is left, I'll try to go in detail to some of the issues. Again, it's obviously we're not going to be able to touch very much on many of the details, but I think it's important to know what the range is. Number one, to know that these questions are dealt with, to know what the range is, to get a general sense of what the consensus is, and also to always be aware, I'm sure you hear this in this framework all the time, that one should consult with Rabbeim and Poskim and Rabbanim who are experienced in these matters. That's how you develop a halachic instinct generally, and it's also indispensable for the process of solving any particular question. You need to know the range, the consensus, and you need to do these kind of due diligence consultations with people who have greater authority and greater sensitivity and experience. Firstly, to note that there are different levels of non-observance. Mostly we talk about somebody who's simply an avarion. If we're talking about somebody even who is pasul liedus, which according to the Rambam means that he's in violation of a lav sheish b'malkus or a lav shomamon, even without malkus. If that's what we're talking about, the consensus view of the poskim is mostly, all things being equal, to take a lenient stand, with some exceptions. The Prima Gadim, I hope we'll get to it, but the Prima Gadim is of the opinion that you can't give an aliyah as a kind of an edus, and therefore anybody who's possibly edus is also possible for an aliyah. People ask, what about the Ketanim and Nashim on the Doraisa level? But obviously, even the Prima Gadim himself, you know, refers to this being more of an issue of avaryanim, you know, than it is, you know, the gavra per se. But that's certainly a shitas yachid, an interesting shitas yachid, one which is inspirational, I guess, in a certain perspective on Kriyas HaTorah. But the consensus view is that when it comes to giving an aliyah to somebody who's simply an avaryan, meaning somebody who's possibly edus, then mostly that's not a problem. Kahuna violations is a more complicated issue. just trying to map out some of the categories. Mostly, kuna violations can just be a lav sheyesh b'malkus or something like that. And as such, in terms of most things in the Beis HaKnesses, you wouldn't treat it any differently. However, when it comes to the role of the Kohen in the Beis HaKnesset, you might treat it differently. In other words, the Vikidashto, the idea that Mechabdin also Rishon, and that he gets, you know, the Aliyah of Kohen, or in terms of Duchening, this is a very big issue. Nesias Kapayim, again in Chutzlars, we don't have it so often, but, you know, when we do, the idea that somebody who is in violation of Kedushas Kahuna, that might impact his ability to function as a Kohen in the Beis HaKnesses, that's a big question. Here we find a machlokes Rishonim already, and the poskim. Many people are machmir on this matter, and again, it's an interesting topic. Many people think he can certainly receive a general aliyah, but again, lechabdo Rishon, there's a consensus view, I think, in the Rishonim and Achronim, that this might be a problem. That this would be a problem. Somebody who's married to Grusha, Kohen is married to a Grusha, things of this sort. The next category is a Mumar L'Teyavon. Aside from coordinating particular parshios, that's also an issue. Can you give a known Mumar L'Teyavon? He goes to McDonald's all the time. Okay, should you give him the Aliyah? You know, in Parshas Re'eh that speaks about Nevela, or in Mishpatim that speaks about Trefa, or in Shmini that speaks about Behema Temeah. So that's a fascinating question. Chassam Sofer and others were of the opinion that that's a problem. Other earlier poskim actually thought it was a great idea. You know, he'll get the Aliyah and he'll become a new man. So again, that's an inspirational idea too. But both from the perspective of being a kind of chucho tlula chil Hashem, you know, for the people, you know, this is who, you know, the McDonald's frequenter is the guy who's getting the kashrus aliyah. So you can understand that it's not just the narrow question of, you know, coordinating aliyos with a person's particular avera. It's it reflects again a certain question of balancing the encouragement of people and hopefully, you know, seeing it as part of a process that will impact on them and transform them on the one hand, and at the same time protecting the integrity of the shul and the Kriyas HaTorah and the people around you, you know, who shouldn't walk away with a wrong impression. The consensus view of Mumar L'Teyavon generally is to accept the formulation of the Shach in Yoredeya, that even in more severe averos, if the violation is L'Teyavon, that Kedushas Yisrael itself is not compromised. And then it becomes simply a question, I say, about particular parshios, or it becomes the Chil Hashem question in particular. If somebody is like a known Avarian, and you see him and say, he's the guy who does this particular Avera. He doesn't just happen to have Averas that he does. So then, of course, are other issues, an inveterate or unrepentant Avarian, in particular Averos. So this is a big discussion of there's a tshuva, the Chacham Tzvi in particular, we have it here, which is very harsh. Chacham Tzvi says you can't honor such a person, you can't be mekabed him. If you do, it's Chil Hashem. People shouldn't just, it's not only prohibited, people should leave such a shul if they give Averos to such people. His son, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, wrote a tshuva in which he's much more mekel, and in which he says, well, my father's tshuva was written about somebody who's an inveterate, and it is, but he just highlights that, somebody who, it's known, and, it's perceived that you're honoring this person, you know, despite the fact, or, you know, in the context of his avera. But otherwise, and he discusses the problem of, single avarian or tinok shenishba, Mumar L'Hachis is, of course, the next level. The consensus of many poskim is that Mumar L'Hachis is somebody who does lose his Kedushas Yisrael and shouldn't be able to do very much. Many or most poskim believe that such a person is disqualified from Tzir Flaminyan and certainly being Motzi Acheirim Yidei Chalvasan, which also includes an Aliyah. I mentioned that Rav Herzog, in one of his tshuvas, leaves the door open based on an expanded understanding. This is, of course, also intellectually fascinating, of Afalpi Shechata Yisrael Hu, which he argues, you know, the idea of Mumar Ka'akum is only L'chumra, not L'kula, when it comes to performance of mitzvot. So we don't find this idea so much. He has a very interesting idea. If I get a chance to read it later, he's Mechalek between dinim that depend on Yisrael and B'nai Yisrael. He points out that a ger is a Yisrael, but he's not a B'nai Yisrael, is his category. He's not the child of Yisrael. And a mumar, a mashumad, is a B'nai Yisrael, even though he's not anymore acting like, or maybe he loses the status of Yisrael. So these are important issues. And then he discusses whether tefillah is patterned after karbonos, in which case it would be very machmir, especially karbonos tzibor, or not. Maybe tefillah is more of a yachid kind of an issue. And he also discusses, again, the question of tinuk shenishba for a mumar lahachis. He takes the approach that, you know, one should try to find a way. In the end, he says, you know, if this is the only shul that you have, you know, maybe we should close down the shul. So he vents his frustration even as he looks, you know, for a way to not accommodate, but to be makarev rechokim. Chilul Shabbos b'farhesia is particularly an issue and a problem. The problem of tinuk shenishba here, the teyov and lahachis. The Gemara, of course, in Chulin daf hey, tells us that a mumar l'chalos haShabbos, a mumar l'chol Torah kula. Rashi explains he's implicitly makhish of the mais sabreishis. His ability to give such a person ali as a maisim shebechol yom, you know, kind of an issue. Rav Moshe Feinstein in his tshuvas has a different perspective on this question. He says the issue is not so much whether or not he's a mumar l'chol Torah kula or not. He thinks in two directions are two different issues at play. He says when it comes to brachos, and particularly Kriyas HaTorah, that's to him the issue is not so much whether formally the person loses his Kedushas Yisrael or has a shame Yisrael or what kind of avarian he is. The issue is whether or not it's a bracha levatala. He says, listen, if somebody doesn't believe, if somebody's a kofar b'ikar, and he's an atheist, or he believes in something else, or you know, he's up there just mouthing words that he doesn't believe in, then it's hard to justify that such a person could be a shliach for Klal Yisrael to motzi them in a mitzvah when it has no meaning. He's more than misasek himself. So if such a person qualifies with full Kedushas Yisrael, but the bracha has no meaning whatsoever to him, it's just mumbo-jumbo, some, you know, ancient or archaic ritual, Rav Moshe says, that's a bracha levatala, and that's a red line, it shouldn't work. On the other hand, he says, if we're talking about somebody for whom brachos are meaningful, it could be that we might be very expansive in allowing him to do things in the Beis HaKnesses, even if his status is one of mumar l'chol HaTorah kula. You have to read the details, but this is a perspective that he discusses. When it comes to kofrim and apikoros, again, Moshe has very specific perspective, especially in terms of the status of conservative and reform rabbis. There's been a lot of discussion in recent years whether that should be amended. You know, even people who accepted Ramosha's very harsh view that, you know, deviationist movements constitute a real heresy in every respect. Because the original reform and conservative rabbinate was, you know, made up of people who you know, should have known better, and, you know, in the last, as it's unfolded, you know, now it's made up of more tinok shenishbas, and people just don't have a clue. And in some cases, people who are actually much more sincere, I think. Maybe we'll speak about that also. So there's been some question whether or not categorizing all, conservative reform rabbis under the rubric of min or apikoros is necessarily, and has, of course, other implications as well, but this is the view of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Intermarriage, of course, is another issue. And here, too, there's some question about, more recent developments. It was generally accepted, certainly when I was growing up, and certainly in years previous, that intermarriage, while technically just kind of an aveira, had the symbolic significance of a total act of merit, and a person who turns his back on Klal Yisrael. And indeed, the Makoros about intermarriage, and the Sugyas about it, and the Rambam's formulation really links intermarriage with Avodah Zarah in many respects, because if family life can be lived outside of Klal Yisrael, obviously that's a major statement, a betrayal of the religion. And that, again, the lumdus of that is important as well. But certainly that's the way it was seen, and people used to sit Shiva for people who intermarried, and it was unacceptable even among non-religious Jews. It was just an unacceptable thing, you know, just a total anathema. Unfortunately, tragically, you know, the numbers have climbed steadily, and the idea even that there's no stigma in the secular Jewish world, there's almost no stigma left in intermarriage. That doesn't make it objectively any less problematic, but the question is whether it affects its status as a total act of rebellion, which is treated differently than the extent of its objective aveira. Personally, my view is that it's still the only hedge against intermarriage and assimilation, and that one should be very strong on this issue. But you should be aware that there's been recent discussion about this. Rav Moshe Feinstein in his tshuvas, which again we have here, discusses what about giving. He says the certain doctor in the community, and he helps everybody, he's a Baal Chesed, and they wanted to be mechabed, and he came into the shul, they wanted to give him psicha la'aron ha-kodesh. Nothing halachically problematic about that, but he's an intermarried person. So he discusses, he says, most of the poskim will tell you that somebody who's intermarried, it's not just the aveira, it's the symbol, etc. He says, but you might have to assess it. If this is somebody who does great chesed for the Jewish community and others, you know, maybe there's, it was a bit of a shocking tshuva. Rav Moshe leaves a Pesach under such conditions, you know, to be mechabed, you know, such a person, as long as everybody understands that you're not soft on intermarriage, but that you're zeroing in on his good deeds. But he himself is very hesitant about it. Yeah, there's a tshuva there, so you should look at it. The status of an orel is also something that needs to be defined, especially when it comes to matters of kahuna, the connection to avoda. Maybe we'll discuss that if we have time later on. So these are some of the categories. Applying the categories is also difficult, and let's take 30 seconds to mention some of the issues. Most of the issues refer to a regular mispalel who comes into shul, and the question is, he has yahrzeit, can he daven, can he get an aliyah, can he be given the kibud of opening the aron, etc., or doing hagbah, maybe even galila. But that's one kind of question. For kohanim, as we said, it's the first aliyah and other things and the siyas kapayim. That might be different. A tziruf l'minyan is an intriguing question. In the poskim, they explicitly, based on the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch, that somebody who's benidui cannot be mitzarif to a minyan. The question is, even though there's nothing else wrong, or only nidui, because that's what nidui means. It means that he is ostracized. Ostracized means you can't be somebody, by definition, who creates a minyan. So this, of course, tziruf l'minyan is an intriguing question. The relationship between tziruf l'minyan and getting an aliyah, you can probably figure out, is going to be a complex question. Lesser kibudim are obviously easier. Psicha, glila, hagba, more of an issue of chil Hashem and chanifa. Serving as a shliach tzibor is obviously even more of a problem than just getting an aliyah, for various reasons. Being the president of a shul, being the member of the board of a shul, are there standards for that? These are also discussions in the postgame. Okay, so that's just a general outline of some of the things to look at and some approaches. If we have time, we'll go into more detail, but now turn things over to the practical side.
I received my smicha 2 days after Shavuos in 1950. It's a few years ago, I assume. And I was in the active rabbinate for a period of 48 years. That's until 1997. And my involvement was not only on a congregational level, but over the years I was extremely active in Rabbinical Council of America, and I was their president, as a matter of fact, between 1978 and 1980, and remained very much involved afterwards in a number of different capacities. So I know a little bit about the rabbinate. And the truth of the matter is that during the course of my active lifetime, there have been some very tremendous changes that have taken place in the rabbinate. And yet at the same time, there are certain elements and certain problems that still exist. As I listen very carefully to the Rosh Yeshiva, who happens to be my son as well. When I first started, I still remember that I had to have an interview with the placement director of the yeshiva. That was before I had smicha yet. He was a very nice person. But in the course of the conversation that we had, he said to me, he's heard me, I'm a good speaker on this, on that, whatever it is. And then he said, you want to go into the active rabbinate? And I said, I do. And so he said to me, good, good. And as he was describing to me the possibilities, he said to me the following. And of course he said to me, if necessary, you'll take a mixed pew position. That's the placement director of our yeshiva, not of the seminary, but of our yeshiva. And I was sort of taken aback, and I said to him, of course I won't.
He still has the job?
I said to him, of course I won't, I said to him. And so he said to me, I'll never forget it. He meant it well. He wasn't trying to be... So he says, well, you're going to have a difficult time in the rabbinate. So I remember I gave him two answers at the time. I said to him two things. I said, number one, if I wanted a mixed pew position, I could have done what a lot of other graduates of Yeshiva College did in my time. I could have gone to the Jewish Theological Seminary and I would have gotten a better mixed pew position than anything you can offer me, I said. And secondly, I said, if there are no positions without mixed pews, then obviously I wasn't meant for the rabbinate, and God will find something else for me. I got a position without mixed pews. I paid a price for it. The kind of salary that I got was the price that I paid. But I never complained about that at all. The truth of the matter is that when I first started, the changes are of seagoing dimensions. When I first started, an Orthodox shul was Orthodox only in the sense that it's not in terms of its membership, only in terms of its structure. Even though the people who were members of my shul, 80% of them, 90% of them were first generation Canadians. They weren't even first generation. They were immigrants who had come to America. Or in my case, in Toronto in Canada. They were immigrants who had come to Canada. But over the years, things began to change for them. I had a balabas in my shul in order for you to understand what all of this looked like and what the rabbinate looks like even today in some areas. I had a balabas in my shul who prided himself in the fact that he was a gera chassid. Not only was he a gera chassid, but when he was a boy, he was allowed to lie under the table of the gera rebbe. That's how important his father was. He came to shul every day. He came to shul on Shabbos. But he did exactly the same thing on Shabbos that he did every other day. And that was that after he was through davening, he'd go down to the corner, which was one of the main streets in Toronto. He'd make a left turn right into his furniture store, where his wife and his son and his daughter were already there. doing business all morning until he finished davening and came to shul. I discovered when I came to my shul that on Shabbos morning I had an express minyan. Not to be confused with what? An hashgama. What was the difference? The people who came to that express minyan were 99% Avelim, who wanted to say Kaddish and then go to work. And they didn't want to sit around going through the davening and through the whole morning and listening to a rabbi's sermon. But instead, they zooped through the davening. They got finished as quickly as possible. And they went off to work on Shabbos morning. You won't find that today. But that was a reality. The result was that the rabbi, looking at his congregants, looking at the situation as it existed in those years, and this is true even today to a degree in certain communities, had to be able to understand that reality. On the one hand, and this is important even to this day, on the one hand, from the day one, no matter where I was, whether it was Toronto or New York, one thing was clear. When it came to halachic matters, when it came to religious matters, there was only one decisor, one person who made the decision. And that was the rabbi. No matter what the issue, if it was religious in nature, there was only one person who spoke. That's a sine qua non. You never allow balabatim, no matter who they think they are, to get involved in religious decisions. That's extremely important. On the other hand, you're dealing with certain realities. In Toronto, and even in the beginning of the year, in the early years in Kew Gardens, it was inconceivable not to give an aliyah to someone who wasn't a complete Shomer Mitzvahs and Shomer Shabbos. You couldn't have had a minyan without them. I still remember, I mean, if you want to understand the mentality that existed in many of these places, once we used to have a minyan, we were one of, not every shul in Toronto had a minyan for Minchat Maariv. We always had one. I made sure we would always have one. Just as my predecessor, Rabbi Kelman, who I see was just honored recently by Torah Masorah, made sure as well. So one day I had 9 people. So I send out the shamus to get the 10th man. So he comes back to me and he says he found he came across a teenage boy. A Jewish boy. And he said to him, come on in, I need you for a minyan. So he says, no, he says, I can't come to shul. My father is still alive. That was the mentality of that time. So on the one hand, when it came to giving aliyahs, for example, you couldn't look at whether you wouldn't be able to give the Shiva Aliyahs, the 7 Aliyahs that you had to give on Shabbos. Because while the shul was Orthodox, in that period of time, if 10% of the people who were members of my shul were Shomer Shabbos in the full sense of the word, that was a lot. You have to reach out to these people. You have to work with them. It took time. It was not an easy matter. It's not an easy matter today either with everything. But there were certain things, certain rules that I did enforce. For example, we had a chazan in the shul. I insisted that chazan always had to be a Shomer Shabbos, and as much as possible Shomer Mitzvos. I couldn't go in to check on him in every detail. But for example, when I came to Toronto, the chazan, in the middle of everything, I hear the chazan take his tuning fork out, and boom. It was sort of a shocker to me, but that's how you learn. So I called in the chazan together with the president of the shul, and I said to him, "This can't happen again." And I remember the chazan kept saying, "But Rabbi, in order for me to sing properly, I need the tuner." I said, "Well, you better learn another way to sing better." I said, "Because the tuner is out." And the president is sitting there, and he's torn between me and the chazan. I think he would have wanted to go for the chazan, but he was afraid that I would make a religious issue out of it, so he kept his mouth shut. But that was the reality. And the other reality, though, in those years, and that was true, I was up to a certain point, is that we were in the business of making Balei Tshuva when the Balei Tshuva movement didn't exist. We were doing it one by one. And it wasn't always easy. It was Tzav L'Tzav and Kav L'Kav, Ze'er Shom and Ze'er Shom. It was a slow process, piece by piece. I had a balabas in the early years of my shul. I had a balabas in my shul who came from the western part of Canada. His father was a shoychet. But by the time he had reached his maturity, he had long forgotten his background. And he came to Toronto. And he married in Toronto, and he became a very successful businessman. And he moved into my area. And then he had a son, and I think that he came to me to come from the Bris, and I came to the Bris. He had a daughter before, and he had a son. And something stirred within him. And he, while he wasn't ready to become from, he started to come to shul on Shabbos. He lived about 8 blocks from the shul. But I didn't know it at the time, but he used to drive to a block away from the shul, then he used to walk from there to the shul. That wasn't unusual, I found out later on. He slowly but surely became much more religious. In those years, today, for example, when it comes to Sukkot, everybody and his grandchild has a lulav and esrog. In my time, that wasn't the case. A lulav and esrog was only someone who had money, who was a richer Jew. The shul had 3 or 4 esrogim, and that we used to circulate amongst the Balabatim. The overwhelming majority of them didn't have it. Anyways, this Jew slowly but surely was becoming more, he wanted to learn more, and so he remembered Sukkot, he bought himself a lulav and esrog. The first 2 days of Yom Tov, he came with great parad, with great joy, he came to shul, and Amachaya, it came to Shabbos Chol Hamoed, and just before the davening, seriously, one of my balabatim, who was a real joker, came running in, with a big smile on his face. Oh, he was so happy. It was unbelievable. Comes running in and he yells out, so-and-so, Lou, so-and-so. He's coming with his Lulu Vanessery. He parked his car a block away and he just walked out and he has his Lulu Vanessery. Ah, here is a chance to really beat up on somebody. So what did I do? I called the usher, the chief usher of the shul over, and I said to him, Nat, do me a favor, run out and head off Lou so-and-so and tell him to take his Lulu Vanessery and put it back in his car. And that's what happened. But this is the reason I'm telling it to you is you never know. You have to reach out to people. I wanted to make sure he wouldn't be embarrassed. I don't have to tell you what it means for someone to go through this kind of boshes ponim. It's unbelievable. He came to me later because he understood since he was told that and he thanked me profusely. And within a matter of 2 years, he was a complete and absolute Shomer Shabbos. And he became a Shomer Shabbos for the rest of his life. You never know. I had another Bala Boss in those early years who over a period of time, he was a European Jew, came to America, lost it all, slowly but surely came back. He used to drive to shul and he stopped driving. Anyways, I got the hoof and he moved out of my area. He moved out of the area. Anyways, the Shabbos after he moved out, I see him in shul. Now, I knew there was no way he could walk to shul from where he lived, that new area where he lived. What do you do under those circumstances? I decided to err on the part which is less cautious and more religious. I didn't say a word to him on Shabbos. Not a word. I greeted him as I normally greeted him. But on Motzai Shabbos, I called him and I said, Jack, do me a favor, come and see me on Sunday. I want to talk to you. So he came to my house. And I said to him at the time, listen, you made such progress. You were here, you became a complete Shomer Shabbos, you stopped driving, you came to shul every Shabbos. I said, you moved up there and you came down driving to this Shabbos. I said, that was the only way you could get here. He says, yes, he says, but Rabbi, I'd love to hear your sermons. That's a plug for me. But he says, I'd love to hear your sermons, he said to me. So I said to him, listen, I said, I'm glad you love to hear my sermons, but I says, it's more important for you to love to do what God wants you to do. I said, you know, the Rabbani Shalom wants you to do only one thing, and that's to be a Jew in the fullest sense of the word. I says, you have a wonderful shul up there, and I told him the name of the shul. I says, you go in there, it's close by, you become a member of there. I says, you can come and see me anytime you want, except on Shabbos and on Yom Tov. I said, it's more important for you to do that than to listen to my sermons. My sermons, they come, they go, but what you do with your Shmira Shabbos will stand you in good stead forever. He never came to shul again. And I felt very good because I felt I had achieved something. My president wasn't happy because we lost a member. But I was not concerned at all. But that was the reality in that period of time. Later on, the issues become a little less different because by the time I came to Kew Gardens, for example, it was the beginnings of a different world. You have to understand how different it is. When I was a student here in the yeshiva, we created a group called the Dov Revel chapter of Apollo Mizrahi. obviously it was a Paul Mizrahi chapter. And we were part of the Paul Mizrahi group. Now, in that time, there were many, the young Israel. Yeah, the young Israel. In that period of time, the young Israel movement had dances. And so did Paul HaMizrahi. The only Paul HaMizrahi group that didn't have a dance was ours. And I have to be frank with you, I was probably the main reason why they didn't have a dance. As you can see, I'm an old auction. But that was the reality of it. When I came to Kew Gardens, the world already was beginning to change. And I was in Kew Gardens only for a period of about 2 months when the president of the shul called me, and he was a very good friend of mine, and he said to me, you know, we have the shul's annual dinner was coming up. So he said to me, what are you going to do about the dancing? Now, when I was in Toronto in later years, I was able to cut out the dancing altogether. We never had any dancing in either show that I was in. That was a given. But here, all of a sudden, he tells me that the shul has not only a dinner, but a dance as well. So he said to me, what are you going to do about it? So I said, what did my predecessors do about it? Now, you have to know, I'm not going to mention names, but my predecessors were very, very distinguished rabbis. With good reason. So he says, well, they didn't do anything about it. So he says, maybe it's time to do something. I'm telling you this story because you have to understand that even when you have to do something which is the right time, you have to do it the right way sometimes. This was a shul that, when I came, was about 30 years old. And they were accustomed to this. So he said to me, I'm inviting you to the board meeting, which is in three days' time. And then you can talk about it. Anyways, I came to the board meeting. And I sat with the members of my board. I'm only the rabbi 2 months. And I said to them, gentlemen, I understand that you have a dance every year together with the shul dinner. That was the big fundraising affair of the year. I don't know how you do it today, but that was it then. It still is in my shul to this day. I said, but gentlemen, I said, fact is that dancing halachically is not permissible. So I said, you know what? I said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I don't know whether you would have done this, but this is what I did. I said, you know, I said, I'm going to allow you to dance. But on one condition, I'll allow husbands to dance with their wives. My assumption is that if there are any halachic problems, that you'll know, husbands know whether or not their wives are at a certain stage, and you'll act accordingly. However, I said, instead of saying chas v'chalila, I used the English, I said, God forfend, I said, should I catch anyone dancing with someone else's wife, and that will be the end of it. I know human nature, that much I always knew. I always had a feel for human nature. I came to the shul dinner, and sure enough, there's this dance. I'm sitting there, I don't say a word, I look around, and sure enough, I knew exactly this was going to happen. And the result was, after the dance, all the acute thing is this, by the way, I must tell you in passing, when I made this pronouncement of mine the next day in shul, the founding president of the shul, who was a very nice guy, and who I got along with very well. He came over to me and he said to me, "Rabbi," he says, "I'm terribly upset with you." So I said to him, "David," I said, "why are you upset with me?" He says, "because you've broken the tradition of the shul." So I put on a big smile. Seriously, I put on a very big smile, and I said to him, "David," I said, "there are certain traditions that are worthy of being broken." I says, "and unfortunately, this is one of them." And from that dinner on to this very day, there has never been another mixed dancing in our shul. I realized at the time that these people were so into it that it would have become a major issue for them. This way, by putting it within a certain context, I was able to ease it out within a matter of once and over. And I'm talking now 43 years later. While on the one hand, I've always allowed people who are not Orthodox to get aliyahs, and that's done because people who have a yahrzeit, who have this and who have that, I try not to allow someone who's not frum to get to the omnit. When I was still in Toronto, I had one balabas, for example, who was a Shomer Shabbos, basically, but who on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur used to go to a conservative temple to daven shacharesim. So I called him aside, he was somebody, he loved the omnit. I discovered this is what he did. I called him in and I said to him, "listen," I said, "I know you're a Shomer Shabbos and everything, but," I said, "you, if you cannot go to daven at a conservative temple and go to the omnit here." So I said, "listen carefully," I said, "this can't happen again. You have to promise me, you have to give me your word that you will never do this again. Otherwise, you can never go to the omnit again." And so of course, he promised, but he didn't keep the promise, and so I never let him go to the omnit again. I also had a situation in Kew Gardens where someone who was not a Shomer Shabbos wanted to daven for the omid, not on Shabbos, but during the week. And many of my balabatim were terribly upset that he should be allowed. By this time, 99% of the shul members are Shomer Shabbos, which is good and bad. The good part is you have Shomer Shabbos members. The bad part is you can't get at anybody who's not a Shomer Shabbos, because they're not part of your Kehillah. So they came to me and they said, "we don't want X to daven." So how did I get around it? I didn't want to hurt his feelings. At the same time, they weren't wrong. So I announced that I have a yahrzeit on the same day. This is what is known as what, a little white lie? And for years, he and I had the same, I used to go to the omnit every time he had yahrzeit. I went to the omnit because after all I'm the rabbi, and I have schus kadima in that sense, in order to ensure that. Now what I conclude with this, because I just want you to understand that you have to stand for principle. I never allowed anyone to interfere with the basic halacha in any circumstance, but at the same time, as rabbis, you have to use your seichel. The fifth Shulchan Aruch was given to you for a reason. And if you know how to use it, you can diffuse many situations and create many other good situations. The important thing is to be able to balance it and to understand it, both in the way that Moshe Feinstein depicts it, and the way Rav Chaim depicts it, because each one of them has a different, slightly differently different element, which is important. And if you do, I hope you'll all be very successful rabbis. Okay, I've done mine here. You want to finish off?
I think it's late, so I'll Od Chazon away some other time. But there's obviously a lot to
discuss. Anybody who has any questions can always ask them, obviously.
Yeah, there's obviously a lot to discuss on the Pratim, which if we had time we would go into, but it seems like there's no time. What? No, not at all. But I think the main, as I said when we began, the important thing is to provide a little bit of perspective.
Exactly.
It should be, a continuing process in terms of the details. I think I'll dive in after the chabura.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.